Yo, what's going on, everybody? It's a Tuesday night stream. Kind of surprise y'all. It's a little late, but it's early on the West Coast, and that's where our guest is from today. So to get things started off, we're going to briefly kind of talk about this Dish Network. They had a breach, and they didn't tell anybody. So we're going to bring our guest up, and then we'll get to talking about it. Good evening. How you doing?
Hi, Henri. How are you?
I'm doing well. So, you know, earlier we were talking about, I said, this would be like a good icebreaker. And he was like, I got Sling too.
Right. I find it quite interesting that here you were sending me an article about Dish Network. And as I was reading the article, I go, oh, first of all, I didn't realize Sling TV was owned by Dish. But secondary to that, wait a minute, they had a breach and customer data was like caught under or by hackers. And by the way, so I haven't received any kind of notification by email or anything from the company to notify me, like, perhaps I should be looking at my identity trackers because now my customer data is out there. So, yeah, welcome to the world of incident response.
Right, because right here it says, Dish said in the filing that the attackers extracted certain data from its IT systems, noting that this data may include personal information. It's unclear whether it's personal, belongs to Dish employees, customers, or both. And the scale of the data theft remains unclear. Dish has about 10 million customers across its streaming, satellite, TV, and other services. And it's funny enough that you said you had Sling. I used to use Sling, but honestly, I didn't justify having it because I really only used it to like watch basketball and sometimes football. And depending on the region you're in, it won't show the games you want to watch anyway. So I was like, this is a waste of money. So I just had to let it go. But thanks for tuning in with us tonight. You know, welcome to the Textual Talk podcast. I'm your host, HD, where we bring it to you every podcast episode, talking about career advice, tech news, like we just brought it to you, and much more. Today, we're going to be blessed with listening to a 20-year vet in the game. She is a privacy engineer. And if you guys know, like, we're in this digital age where we have so many apps, where when you sign up for the app, it gives you like this, these things you can read and say, you know, click I agree or whatever. And, you know, most of the time we don't read all that. So she is one of the people that actually delves into like, what about our privacy? Where is our data going? Like, who has access to it? And, you know, that's what we're going to talk about today. So without further ado, you know, let's welcome our guest, Miss Erin Relford. I got you covered.
Love that. You have your own music. Awesome.
Thank you for joining us tonight. Do you want to tell the guests a little bit about you and a little bit about your background?
Yeah. So Henri, when you say 20 year, God, I feel old, but you know what they say, black don't crack, right?
No, you're not getting old, you're getting better.
That's it. I'm getting better. I would say that my 20 year history has incorporated a lot of Fortune 100 and Fortune 50 companies. So I've been in a studio entertainment. So I've worked at Fox, the Walt Disney Company, as well as Warner Brothers. Also had a stint at Mattel, as well as Waste Management, those who incorporate Waste Management as a, or not a customer, you are a customer of Waste Management. And then I also did a side stint on doing consulting with Big Four. So I have existed in the world of governance, risk, and compliance for the last 20 years and have moved on to now privacy, as Henri mentioned, doing privacy engineering.
Cool. So what is, so you kind of gave us your background, but you know, I like to ask this question that like, who are you outside of like all this stuff, like, who are you? Because, you know, to have like a long career, like in any tech driven role where technology is constantly changing, kind of got to immerse yourself in it. And a lot of times people assume the identity of their job. But I know a lot of us are much more than what we do, you know, 9 to 5. Shoot, some of us only work 2 hours out of the day, but get paid for 8 hours. So who is Erin? Like, who is Erin Relford?
Henri, that is such a great question. Thank you for asking. Who is Erin? I always like to tell people that if tech is my wife, I love tech. I'm a very curious person. So that I think that's why I have always thrived within tech. I love to just kind of get my hands on things as far as like I used to build my own computers like way back when the internet first came aboard, like AOL and a Prodigy or what have you. Like I was the one on there trying to figure out like, what is this, right? But in terms of tech being my wife, I tell people I will one day leave my wife for my mistress, which happens to be writing. I absolutely love to write, whether it be essays, short form, screenwriting. I'm very much an expressive person. I also love, some people look at it in terms of mentorship, but for me, networking is a sport. It's something I actually look forward to, as well as baseball. I love baseball. I love dancing too. I feel like I'm giving you my rundown on my dating profile, but that's who I am. I am a writer, a lot of things, but most of all, I'm a curious cat. So yeah, you can find me pretty much reading and absorbing information wherever I can get it.
That's dope. I mean, hey, I've always wanted to do a dating show, you know, with this network I built of mine. I think I have, you know, some qualified applicants, you know, that maybe could go on your attention. Right. But no, I like that. I like that you said that, because like even with me, right, it's like love being in, you know, InfoSec. But then I love creating. I was tweeting a while ago about like I got in trouble all the time for my mouth. Even now, I had to catch it. Like, it could be a conversation that's supposed to be like 5 minutes and end up turning to 15, 20, 25. And now I have to tell somebody, you know what, I'm going to let you go, because if not, I will talk, you know, your ear off. But when I started doing this, which I never knew where, you know, where it's going to go, I didn't really even plan it. Like, I just said, you know, I want to start it. I want to do it. But as I start learning more and more about, you know, educating myself about podcasts and learning and equipment and how to do this and that, it's like, you know, it's felt like something that I don't get tired of doing. It feels natural. So like you, content creation and, you know, talking to people and helping people and inspiring people is like the next part of like the journey on down the line. So thank you for that. So did your career start off with you going into privacy engineering, or did you do any like buffer roles like some of us did, like when we kind of started off in our career?
Yeah. So as far as starting off, well, let me ask you how you want me to answer that.
How you want to answer it, you know what I'm saying?
Gotcha. So I actually started my career, like my professional career, as a receptionist working at, the company is called Fugro. They are basically a civil engineering firm. And I had just moved to Houston, Texas from Little Rock, Arkansas, and was looking for a job because I had just enrolled at the University of Houston. And I was working full time, going to school full time. So I just needed something. And at the time, they were paying $11 an hour. So like, that was great, right? It's probably great now, actually, while we're sitting here talking. But yeah, so I started off as a receptionist, and, you know, everyone's coming through the door. So all the engineers would stop, talk to me. I'm an extrovert, so I would talk to everyone. And it wasn't before long that they started to notice that I picked up a lot quicker on the work. And so it just so happened that one of the engineers, the only woman engineer in the building, might I add, was going on maternity leave. And so she looked at me and was like, do you want to do this work? You know, maybe you learn a little bit more on your journey. And I was like, sure. So I became the quality assurance manager. And at that point, what does that basically mean? So I was checking the engineer's work, like checking their math and making sure that the calibrations on all of our equipment were up to code. We had different kinds of certifications that or qualifications within certifications that we had to meet because we did testing for like nuclear plants. And so it's like serious work. Anyway, that's how I got my start into IT audit, because it just so happened that the safety director comes by and says, hey, do you want to come do this ride with me? What we did was, what I found out was an operational audit. And I go, wait a minute, because I'm in school. And I go, so you can apply audit to IT too? And so the minute I found that out, and the job at the time, like those careers were paying like 50K, which was the dream for me, making right? So I signed up real quick, right? So after I heard about A2LA certifications, ISO 9001, which is a quality management certification, I was like, let me go. Let me do this. So I graduated, got my degree. And so I finessed my way into waste management with a career as an IT auditor too. And that is just how the transition kind of started. I got scooped up by KPMG. Doubled my salary at the point that I had reached Disney, and making my way into privacy, I always have been the type of person to listen and sniff trends within IT. So at that time, the talk was all about cloud. You know, like, what is this, the cloud? That was such a foreign concept back then. And then transition that into cybersecurity, and then transition that into what you, at that time, we were calling OTT, over the top. You know that as streaming. So like Netflix, Disney Plus. And so I was involved in those early workings in terms of tech. and at the same time doing IT audit. But then GDPR came along. GDPR is a regulation out of Europe, and it's focused on privacy or data protection. And so that was, that's my ticket. I was tired of audit. I didn't want to do the governance work anymore, and rode another certification into privacy engineering. So that is how I got my start in privacy.
Man, you said a lot, especially when you found out about, oh, I can be an IT and audit. Because this is some things that when people come to me from different backgrounds and they're trying to pivot, and I'm looking at their experience, I'm like, oh, you know, you could do this. You've been doing this like at a bank, but then you could do this for a company. That's and they're right. Like, oh, really? I was like, yeah, and they pay a lot. So hats off to you for really doing what I call just always being resourceful, and probably going to use this in the wrong context. That malleable is the wrong context, but pretty much changing with the trends and following the money. That's
absolutely. If I may just like tag that, Henri, you know, Will Smith liked to say, if you stay ready, you ain't ever got to get ready. And I take that to heart when you hear about that quote that says, luck is just preparation meeting opportunity. Mm-hmm. I create my own luck. And so that is why I keep my pulse to what's happening in tech, the trends, because in terms of, and let me just kind of tag your comment about money too. I think my connection is always what is going to keep me interested. Where am I having fun? And it just so happens, because I pursue passion in that sense, the money follows. That's just been my own luck. But
but you also niche down. It's like one of the things you talk about is like, you know, early on in people's career, sometimes when they don't have much experience, they're trying to niche early on. And sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. But I was like, if you just get in the door, then you can figure out something you like to do and you can move that way.
Yeah.
That's kind of like the way that, you know, I try to like persuade them to get there. Cause it's tough out here. It's so much hogwash. I have a video that I covered on like all these 5 million, 4 million, you know, InfoSec roles. And I said, you see on this article, they're lumping all these roles together and trying to say like they're cybersecurity, and that's not the case. That's why they're overinflating the numbers And I'm always saying, because there's a hot take, like I've been telling people, it's a conspiracy in the sense to, hey, go get this certification, go join this boot camp, go do all this and that, so you can get there and then, you know, be number 999 out of 5,000 trying to get an entry level role. So
quick pro tip, if I may, on that, Henri. So I was talking to a young lady a couple of days ago who had asked for a mentoring session, and she had told me that she got a certificate of completion for her CISA. And so I go, did you get the CISA from ISACA, who is the organization that hosts the CISA? And she's like, no, I took it with such and such. And then she started to mention A+ and a bunch of other security certificates. And I go, okay, this is a scenario where she has spent time chasing certs, but like didn't know whether they were valuable or not in terms of her job search, right? And getting back to your point about cybersecurity roles, a good way to kind of find out what's what, like the secret sauce, is to just go on LinkedIn and search, like based on your skill set, right? If there's something you love, we were talking about incident response. So let's just say you like incident response. Go and search the actual jobs for that phrase, and then see what the companies that have those job recs out there, see what the preferred qualifications are, because they typically list the cert. And now you know what search you need to be chasing.
Exactly. That's why I tell people the job description is your study guide and cheat code on how to get the job. Now, the hard part sometimes is some of those skills are gatekept because you can't just access them. But that's when you learn how to network and finesse and say, okay, if I can't learn this, what can I learn that can show I know how to do this? So you're on it. And like I said, we have to just listen to you because you've just been able to do this for like so long. Before I get into more of my questions, were you at Disney when Disney Plus launched?
I was at Disney pre-Disney Plus. Okay. So like 2012 through 2014, I was at Disney. And then Disney bought a portion of Fox, and I ended up back at Disney in 2019. So, yeah.
Okay. No, because so I've told this a couple of people, but like I was on pretty much I used to work for Optiv. So Optiv had a contract with Disney. So we were the blue team for them when Disney streaming launched, and they were like, hey, be on high alert. We got all this and these different dashboards and stuff like that. So I was like, it was pretty cool that, hey, like, I was making sure, like, you know, we didn't notice any things happening to DC streaming. But I can say that's probably one of the most successful service launches in a while. Like, it wasn't too bad. They really fleshed it out. So that was pretty cool to be on the other end of that, to actually contribute to that. And one of the things I try to preach to people when we are working, I say, hey, you know, our job is contributing to the main focus of, like, the company that we either supporting or we directly work for. I was like, so if you can keep that in the forefront of your mind, then it should be very easy to know why you're doing your job and why it's important.
Yeah. So my time at Fox, right, I'm running the cybersecurity program, and the rumblings of OTT is starting to happen. So Netflix is already in the space, right? They were doing DVDs by mail, but they are already getting into streaming. And, you know, this was the time when all of Hollywood was like, oh, Netflix doesn't know what they're doing. They're spending all this cash, right? But at the point that Netflix, like, people started to be at home, started to stream, all the rest of the studios followed suit. And so that particular time, I was like, in terms of, like, following trends, I was like, AWS seems to be the front runner. And GCP, which is Google Cloud, has just started to kind of ramp up, and Microsoft Azure as well. But AWS is what everyone within the industry was using. So what did I do? First thing I did was look who's offering, like, training on this. I took a course at UCLA's Extension School. I forget what they call it. It's Extension something, but it was a 4-month program. I took the Solutions Architect course so that I could set myself up to get certified in AWS. Well, here's the thing, Henri. I absolutely hated it. Like, hated it. And this is, I'm kind of tying in what you're saying, but at the same time, I'm telling people, like, it's always good to kind of get your feet wet with what you think you want to do, because once you're in it, you may absolutely hate it. But tying this back to streaming, so I had been working with the DevOps guys. And I say guys because there were no women in this group. But DevOps was a new term, right? Everybody's like, what is this? Like, who's marrying what, right? Like, what is DevOps? And so as I was auditing the DevOps department, I started to notice, like, the IAM module and all of these security functions and stuff that were, like, super important for everyone to know that was wanting to stand or spin up a cloud and play with it. And so this is what I'm talking about in terms of, like, curiosity and following trends, because, like, now I had kind of got my weight up in terms of AWS, which later transformed into, so still at Fox, there was a president that had stood up a shadow IT group, if anybody knows what shadow IT is, had basically been running a GCP project on their own and, like, doing, like, a bunch of data insights or what have you. And so because I had been curious about AWS, I was able to walk into this president's office and kind of, you know, just do the whole, how are you, that kind of thing. Be nice, right? And was able to audit the GCP project because of what I had learned with AWS. Now, two totally different projects, but because I had done the work on this end, I knew what to look for on that end. All right, I'll stop talking.
No. That's, you're answering questions without me having to ask, because that's the game. That's how you advance your career. Show yourself to be valuable. Hey, I know how to do this. You guys might need help doing this. Let me do this for you. Because I tell people all the time, you know, they'll say, oh, AWS, GCP, Azure. And I had one of a couple of episodes back. She's a cloud support engineer, and she works mainly with AWS. But she told people, you know, on the platform, hey, I would suggest Azure first because it's easier. You kind of been seeing it, you know, the same stuff when you've seen the Active Directory is kind of like the same. But if you take all the entry-level tests, so I've taken Cloud Practitioner and AZ900. It's essentially the same with different service names. And I'm pretty sure GCP is the same way. So if you just have a foundation, like you had that foundation when you got the Solutions Architect, you can probably navigate any cloud environment.
Pretty much. So I'll be honest and say that, like, cloud has gotten so much more robust today, right? Mm-hmm. So all the different services that are being offered, depending on what industry you're in, some services are better to know than others, but you're absolutely right in terms of like that foundational work. It's just like sky's the limit. You like cloud is still a good place to be, even if it's, I don't know if we're like focusing on cybersecurity or
privacy. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be, I mean, all of it really has to work together. Like how I envision it. I was like one can't be done without the other. Everyone needs each other.
There you go.
That's how I look at it. But since we're on the subject of privacy, could you explain to the viewers like what is a privacy engineer and kind of what are they tasked to do or like their day to day? Yeah, let's do that. What is a privacy engineer and what is their like typical day to day? Like what are they responsible for and you know, why are they needed? Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. So a privacy engineer can be a lot of different things. I tell people there are privacy engineers that work on policy, right? So sometimes they're lawyers, sometimes they're not, but people who actually write policy for companies or write standards, right? So that could be a privacy engineer. There are also privacy engineers that actually code. So they are both privacy engineer and SWE, or software engineer for short. There's also privacy engineers like myself who operate as consultants. And so in my space, product teams will come to me and say, hey, we want to build X and we want to use this infrastructure to do it. What do you think? Right. And it's my role to basically find out like what their goals are, who are they trying to reach, these kind of things, and basically like come up with privacy enhancing solutions so that if their end goal is we want to reach as many users as possible and use this information as feedback and like we want to train our models, right, for something, then it's my job to basically make sure that they're instituting or implementing the right infrastructure solutions, or maybe it's something as simple as they want to stand up a website. It's making sure that they are using the right privacy policies and not using dark patterns, where we call dark patterns like when you go to a website and you see the little thing pop up that says, hey, we're collecting cookies. Is that okay? It's an like you have to accept. If the box is already checked, that's a dark pattern because they're already opting you in without you having a choice to do it, without you, like we call it consent, without you consenting to it. And so good privacy practice is to show the box, explain what it is you're collecting, sharing and storing, and at the same time, allow the user to click and say, yes, I agree, and move on. So it runs the gamut from simple to a very complex and complicated, because I was working on robotics as well as like right now I'm working on large language models. So which is AI, another word for artificial intelligence, you know, AI is the new buzzword. So that's what a privacy engineer will do within the consulting space. And then there are also privacy engineers who I would say, like you think about a program manager, they are pretty much like the individuals who run a privacy program for a department or an organization or the actual company.
That's cool, especially when you start talking about the AI and stuff like that, because I don't even, that had to be like early February or maybe late January when you and I first like spoke to each other. And I brought up the use case of ChatGPT saying, hey, could it like look into like people's like old social media? And I tested it out after we got off the call and it could not do that. So I felt like that was cool because I just thought about like how malicious you can use that on like just because they do it all the time. If they go on somebody's Twitter and bring up someone they're like 15 years old or whatever. But that's something I do want to talk about as well. That's like far as there have been like a rise of hackers, you know, manipulating ChatGPT to put like pretty much using social engineering to trick people, say, hey, you know, you can get this premium ChatGPT, but really send them malicious links so they can phish them and get their information. Wow. But, you know, now we're in the age now, like where machine learning, AI, augmented reality, we have all these different things. And now it's just like, at this point, you have to accept if you have anything digital, like, even if you say no to your data being like owned by somebody else or somebody else having access to it, you have to accept like the risk acceptance that like that data doesn't like belong to you no more. Like they're going to do what they want with it. Is it right? No, but that's like my stance on it. And that's being an InfoSec professional. Like I know, hey, I'm using this iPhone or whatever. Now, I would say Apple tends to be one of the the better companies when it comes to trying to protect their users on not just offering up their data. And that's even up to the FBI. I think they did that. Like, I have to find that out. And I might research that while I'll ask you another question. But I remember they did that. Like, they were trying to get their information. It's like, no, we're not giving it to you. I think Zuckerberg tried to do that too. I could be wrong, but
let me push back on you for a second.
Go ahead.
When you say it seems like when you enter your data, you're essentially giving it away, right? And This is no different than you being out in the world and your situational awareness, right? Like making sure that no one's walking behind you. When you give up your data, you should think about how you're doing it as well as why you're doing it. Let me give you an example. Like back in the day when Facebook was popular and you had those games that you could just immediately like play, like how old you'll be when you get married, those kind of things, right? There was a whole process where when you clicked on it, it told you a company would have your Facebook profile, would know what friends you're talking to, as well as your date of birth, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. Another example of that is when we sign up for apps. I'm not going to pick on Lindsay. It might have been another app, but when I went, you notice that they now make you register before you can even get into the service. And so It asked for my birth date, my zip code, my name. And with those three items, they can find out so much about me just with those three, right? Because those are what we consider PII or personal data, personally identifiable information is what we call that. And there are so many intersections with third party sharing data brokers that have other information on you. So if they have the one, your birth date, they can tell a whole trail about where you've been, where you're going, and how you're getting there. And so I say, to push back on that, there are privacy laws in some states. California, where I live, happens to be one. I saw someone in the chat mention CCPA, right? I think Indiana, Ohio, I forget, but one of those Midwestern states also has a privacy law in place. And so Europe is kind of the front runner in terms of privacy regulation, making sure that if someone like you or I like stood up an app, if someone requests their information, I want to know what you have on me. Based on GDPR, they have to provide that to you. Otherwise, they stand to be fined a bunch of money, right? Yep. So GDPR, CCPA, the law is slow to catch up with tech, but they are now starting to fall into place. For anyone who kind of follows the federal government, I think they recently released an AI Bill of Rights, or I forget what it's called, but it's free to go look at and read. And so it's like, we're catching up to it, but you as a person need to be responsible every time you enter something, any piece of technology, right? The way I kind of look at it is, and this kind of relates back to cybersecurity, endpoints. At any point where there's an input or an output, you need to be mindful about the data that you're giving up, what you're giving up. Even with some of these services that are coming up with like ChatGPT, you notice you have to authenticate to use the service, right? And so as a privacy engineer, when I think about that, I go, oh, they can actually tie my user prompts to my ID. And what happens after that? Did you read the privacy policy when you accepted to use the service? I didn't.
Yeah, right. But, and that's also why I tell people, because some people say, yes, but help me do work and stuff like that. I say, I just hope you're not entering confidential information in ChatGPT. Like I do stuff like for my business wise, or if I needed to, like some of these questions that I'm asking you came from ChatGPT. And I'm also just improvising the questions. If I don't like it, the vibe, I'm going with the vibe and improvising, but it'll help me come with the description. Sometimes I'll say, hey, help me do an email campaign under like 500 characters, and it'll do some stuff like that. And then I could just, switch it up. But I tend not to put anything that is, too personal in there, because when you log on to ChatGPT, it has a list of like everything that you looked at. So, or you query. So potentially you don't know if they actually are following compliance. And that's the thing I want to touch on too. It's kind of like, we were talking about Dish Network earlier. We had breaches with Uber last year, Okta, LastPass. Matter of fact, LastPass just came out and said one of the dev guys, they're the people that got hacked in order to how people got access. So it's just like, even though you're trying to be as safe as you can, you can't control I got a good analogy. A parent, I got two girls, and let's say if they ride the school bus, even, or I could say if I'm driving the car, but if I, especially if they're riding the school bus, you know, I'm expecting them to be safe and make the school safe. But yeah, that school bus driver has to do their job, and hopefully the people have to drive on the road right.
Yeah.
So it's like one of those things, like, I can't really control what's going to happen after my child is gone from me. I just have to hope that everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. And I think that's one of the hardest parts when it comes to your data. It's like every single day, oh, this person got, I was like, dang, like, you know, I mean, now for me, I also kind of called it like job security, because I seen Uber was like, you know, hiring a lot of people once, you know, these things happen. But it's just one of those things, like, hey, yeah, it, for me being on Blue Team for years, some of these things are avoidable. And some, that's why a lot of times I like to call either negligence on the Blue Team, or the Blue Team alerted who they needed to. And they were negligent. And that's kind of how I view that. But so, go ahead.
So I will say, Henri, and this is years ago, right? When I was in internal audit, what I noticed every time in talking to the security team was, and we're talking huge corporations, right? Security team was maybe five people. And like, how are five people supposed to keep up with threat modeling, doing the monitoring? What? Yeah, seriously. And at the same time, like, we would come through and be like, so what does your disaster recovery and business continuity plan look like?
I don't know. Right.
And so to your point, as we hear about breach after breach after breach, I've started to ask the question, where has my data not been, you know, uncovered? Because I feel like they're going to have to change social security numbers at some point, like, because the information is just all over the dark web.
Who's policing the police? Not to mention, and this will be a last question, then I'll ask you something else. When we get into, when you said social security, so I just thought about like government, and sometimes when you come to like state, like a lot of times they don't have the people that work at some of these bigger companies that like to be the more attractive talent, or some of their systems may be older. And that's one of the ones that, that are issues. Like we're seeing recently, like over the last 2 years since COVID, school districts are closing down based off ransomware attacks and things of this nature, from probably not having the resources to protect that. So imagine now somebody has your child's information, and they're, shoot, they open up credit cards and everything and their name, because they, you know, they pulled it from the school.
Yeah.
Or they do even something, you know, more sinister and update the records and put themselves on the checkout list and say, oh, your name's right here. You know, like my guy Antoine Matthews says, he says he don't say the use case, he think about the abuse case. Yeah. So it really can go down a rabbit hole when you really start thinking about, yeah, you can say it's extreme, but, you know, as Cat Williams said on the Friday at the Next, don't be sorry, be careful.
That's right. And so, Henri, you can place this in cybersecurity and in privacy. Mm-hmm. So what I noticed with a lot of write-ups that we ended up having to do, so you talked about outdated servers, and so like companies that were still using Solaris and, you know, just really old, like Unix, Linux servers, and not doing very basic things like patch management. Like, patch management will save you a whole deal of headache, right? And it's not even just being able to have a regular schedule for your patch management is what got most companies in trouble. So it's the same thing with privacy. It's the same thing with you. It's these light touches. If you're just monitoring what you're doing, you can keep yourself safe.
Oh, 1,000%. I tell people all the time, like you said, patch management, let's go patch, asset management, vulnerability management, all of those are essential.
All of those things, yes.
You know, they're not sexy titles, at least for patch management and asset management, but they are needed. You'd be surprised. I was just in a big organization where you're still not knowing who owns this certain firewall rule, this or that. So now you can't even determine, you can determine the risk, but you don't really know what even this asset may be. Like, it's it's crazy. I've said before that a lot of people's infrastructures, you know, being tied together with bubble tape and bubble gum and tape.
Yes.
That's what I said before. Like, it's that finicky. But so I want to ask you, what are some challenges that a privacy engineer may typically face?
So let's talk forward back, right? So when we think about AI, you brought up putting in sensitive information into ChatGPT, right? So privacy engineers in the space of AI may come across, if we had a tool like ChatGPT, you would question, how do we prevent that? And so a privacy engineer's first thought is, we always talk about leading with empathy in privacy. That can translate into user trust. So how does a user trust the system or the tool or product that we've set up? Well, the first thing that I would want within, and I haven't taken a look to see what ChatGPT actually has, but I would want right there in the open text forum for it to basically say, please do not enter anything that could be considered X, Y, and Z, right? And spell that out, because most people in this country don't have more than an eighth grade education. That's the other thing, the other side to tech equity when we create new products, right? So that's the first step.
Actually, I wanted to interject real quick. I think it's actually lower than that.
You're probably right.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, most people in this country read on a fourth or fifth grade reading level.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So if they're playing with ChatGPT and they put in, you know, for lack of a better, like your birth date or whatnot, like the next step would be, so from a privacy engineering standpoint, let's say they did put that information in. What do we do to prevent it? And this kind of applies to both privacy and security. There's prevention and detection, right? So how do we detect that that's happened? And if we do detect it, what do we do? So that the steps kind of walk through, can we mask that data somehow, like pseudonymization or anonymization is our techniques that you can use. A big term in privacy is differential privacy, where you're actually baking it into the cake that something is truly anonymous. That's one step, right? The next step is, if we do obtain this in our storage systems, can we scrub it? Can we delete this data without getting rid of the pieces that we actually need, right, between API calls, et cetera, et cetera? All of these are the challenges that privacy engineers are faced when it comes to things that the public are using in relation to AI, right? But then coming back to like more simple issues that we have challenges about, you know, you might have what we would consider at-risk users, right? If you are utilizing an app to, let's say your clients, your customers are people like prescriptions, let's say diabetes, right? You have a diabetes app. You want to be really sensitive about how you are outlining information. And this is where user experience folks come in at, right? How you are giving that information to a user, because they're taking it in a certain way. And you want to make sure that their privacy is protected when you do that. So it comes down to like the simple things, which notice and consent. There's nothing simple about notice and consent, but simplified in terms of, you know, giving like the right notices and making sure that people consent to what they're giving up on the simpler side. And then I gave you an example on the more harder side, the challenge. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the wild, wild west. Because I just started thinking about, you said at risk. Then you think about people like insider threats and you think about that. And I will say, and whoever is listening to this, if you have a job to use a computer or anything like that, you know, we can see everything you look up. We can see everything you print out, all the stuff you access, and we can see all that. So don't do anything that could potentially land you in jail. Seriously, you know, people do things like they're about to either resign or leave. So they figure, oh, I'm going to just print out all this proprietary information. You know, like that's not going to notify DLP, you know, or right. So it is like, it's one of those things too. Like people don't even know, like, hey, when you get in the job, hey, you consent that, hey, we can look at everything. We can do whatever, blah, 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 blah. Like all that's there too, you know? So you got to be careful about putting your other information you don't want anybody to know on these machines.
Yeah.
But so I would figure, I view what you do as I think it's like one of the things that's like everywhere. Like I consider GRC is like every area like of cyber. I view what you do the same way. That has to be like everywhere. And so one of the questions I want to ask is like, when it comes to like the security team, right? Everybody always want to look like they're like the people that's saying, oh, you can't have fun. And when it's more like a parent saying, hey, you know, I don't care what you do. Just, you know, let me know where you're going to be at so I know you're safe.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to privacy, I'm pretty sure it's just like, how hard is it to get, you know, at the top to buy in saying, hey, this is why we need to do this, this, and this. This is why we need to do it and why it'd be beneficial for us. And how do they like buy into that? Or do you typically like have roadblocks with other teams when you say, you know, that shouldn't be there, we should do this, we need to comply to this standard, this standard? Like, what is that like being a privacy engineer?
Let me approach this as a former auditor, and then mm-hmm. I'll talk about the privacy engineer piece. So the one thing about GRC, Henri, is I call them recession-proof jobs because you're going to always need auditors. So look, cheat code, pro tip. If you will tie your profession to a regulation, a government regulation, you will always be employed because every publicly traded company has to comply with the regulation, right? And so Sarbanes-Oxley, I'll pick on that one for a second, which is a short for SOX, S-O-X, not S-O-C. SOX, every publicly traded company has to comply. And so they are going to always need auditors to look at that information. And so as an auditor, when I would get pushback from people, I don't care who it was, right? Whether it be finance or security, two things always come up. One, do you want, because your CFO has to sign off on SOX, right? For every CFO has to sign off and say they have validated our books are not cooked. Do you want your CFO to have to call you and be like, why did we not do this? That's a hell of a motivator for most people, right? And then on the privacy side of things, we call it brand equity. So if, as an example, let's say big corporation conglomerate, let me pick on Disney as an example. So Disney owns Hulu. If Hulu messes up and has a data breach, which I kind of think they already have, but I could be wrong.
No, they didn't have it, but my old team is still watching.
Well, then they are doing their job. So
okay.
If Hulu were to have a data breach, what's going to happen in the press is not Hulu. It's going to be Disney. Disney leaked customer data. That's going to be the tagline in the New York Times. And so I like to tell people that for brand equity is everything for most companies, right? Your name is everything. And always remember that when it comes to your word is everything. So in terms of brand equity, I like to tell people if, you know, they're pushing back on something that we've asked them to do is just remember that if this shows up in the New York Times, do you want this to be your name that gets tagged to it, you know, as the product manager? Or do you want it to be the company name? Like, think about these things. Those things are real. And so I hope I'm answering your question.
No, you are. You're answering it because it's kind of the philosophy I would use when I would do my jobs. If I came across whether it's the detection that doesn't work or my team's doing something wrong or process that don't make sense or something has changed and it's alerting that we're missing, it's what I bring up. Because I'm like, hey, at the end of the day, I don't bring it up. I may be the one that's saying, you know, hey, sorry, but hey, you know, we got to either get you out the contract or we got to fire you. Mm-hmm. So it's the same philosophy that I take when I do my job. It's like, hey, no, I'm going to bring up everything I can.
There you go.
But so what are some of the most common mistakes that organizations make when it comes to privacy and how can they avoid them? I think this ties into kind of what we just talked about.
Yeah. What are the pitfalls? You actually brought this up earlier. You talked about asset management. Mm-hmm. And you can think about that in the same way you think about data. So if you haven't classified your data, if you haven't tagged everywhere where your data is being stored, that can get you in a lot of trouble, right? Because let me use a very broad example and say you've got, let me pick on Warner Brothers. Here we go. So you've got a gaming department who is standing up a platform. And it just so happens that we've got a database over here with our HBO Max. I'm just making this up as an example. All of our HBO Max customers, let's say the gaming department really likes the database setup. And so you've given them access to that. And some engineer, for whatever reason, created a data pipeline or a data lake, right? And connected the two systems. Well, now you've got all this free flowing customer data. And so if they end up doing something that ends up leaking data on one end where this data was actually supposed to be on this end, when they go to clean up, I forget which department actually does this, right? Like management, or you might call it privacy investigations. When they go back to do the postmortem to see like, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? Well, now they're chasing all over the place looking for data because they didn't tag their data where it was supposed to be. That's one small example of that. Might have been a little bit confusing.
I'm muted. It wasn't. And you'd be surprised how, well, you're not surprised because you're getting it, but the people's watching will be surprised how this is not anything that's not too uncommon. And I'm talking about the biggest of companies you can think of. It's not uncommon that they're running around like chickens with their head cut off because they don't know where things is, or somebody stood something up and you don't know what it is. It's the simplest things can cause like everything to fall down. And this goes from not only if we're talking, we can talk physical access. Somebody is able to, you know, mimic the key cards. Like steal the key and get in, or just watch you and figure out what you stay on it. And if you don't have to, like for me, my first job doing help desk was a TSA contractor. So everyone couldn't come into, first of all, our area. And in order to get into the area, you had the badge and put your PIN in and go in.
Yeah.
Now, at certain companies, I'm there and I'm just like, okay, if this stuff's
supposed to be... on a piece of paper.
No, like it's just a badge. You just badge and you go in. But I'm like, if somebody was to piggyback me and get out of here, mm-hmm. like, what's going to stop them? If they copy my frequency, cool. But if they didn't know the PIN, they can't get in.
Yeah.
So it's like, even the small things, adding that extra layer, you know, or, you know, not having visible security guards, not having cameras where you're supposed to be. Like, all these things, like, tie into everything.
It's the small things. When I was at Waste Management, so the trucks that pick up your trash and take it to the landfill, well, they were using RFID, if anyone's familiar with that. It's a form of a radar or something. I forget what it stands for. But basically, it works the same technology where you have a key fob. And those RFID trucks, or the RFID that was on the trucks, like at the time, no one had questioned what type of data can you pick up from this RFID if you're in the vicinity of it, right? And so to your point, Henri, even with physical security, small things like access, instituting that second level where you had to badge in as well as enter a PIN prevents things from happening.
Yeah. And that just made me think about, like, I'm in Texas now. I'm in the DFW area. So who can get access to where I've been going on my toll tag? I just thought about that. Because, you know, the toll tag will tell you every toll you was and what time you was there.
Yeah. Oh, so, I'm going to scare you in a minute.
I just thought about that. So in your opinion, what impact has the recent surge in privacy regulations such as GDPR and, you mentioned earlier, CCPA had on the industry? Have you seen this be a negative or positive as far as, I guess we could say, if companies are actually, like, for example, I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you would know about this more than me, but back in 2018 sometime was when, like, GDPR, I want to say, might have been passed, or it might have been late 2017. But then you start seeing every company saying, oh, the GDPR thing at the bottom. Or then you start seeing about, oh, we need your cookies, or do you want to accept your cookies? And it seemed like some companies just, like, you know, slapped it on there just to, you know, say that they, you know, they're letting people notice. But I don't know on the back end if they were doing what they were supposed to do. From your experience and your vantage point, what has that looked like for you with those two regulations in the past, like, you know, becoming very important for every company that does business everywhere?
Yeah. So from a user perspective, I think these regulations have been very good, because we talked about eighth grade, fifth grade educations. Most people don't think how they can be harmed. They don't know what type of privacy harms exist. Let me actually tie this to a really good example. So if you think back, Henri, I'm dating myself, right? I'm a Gen Xer. So
yeah, we had this conversation as well when we were.
So when the laptop came about, right? Was one thing. It introduced the internet to all of us. And we didn't know that with websites, child pornography, or with sharing images, child pornography could be a thing. When the smartphone came about, we didn't realize that being addicted to your phone and just constantly there, right, that could be harmful. Social media was the next frontier. We didn't know that 13-year-old kids would start to kill themselves because of being attacked and abused online, right? Mm-hmm. So I would say that from a user perspective, regulation can be a good thing. But on the business side of things, you know, if you're a conglomerate, in order to institute those regulations, it's going to cost you money. You don't have the benefit. It's more of a cost. You know, you hear about a cost benefit analysis.
Right.
Businesses are wearing all of the costs, right? And so where is that money coming from? Like, they have to pay for that. And
they might have to assemble a whole new team just to do that.
Hire new people just to do it. And so you have to first have lawyers. You have to hire lawyers, outside counsel, to understand what does this regulation mean for us? Because for each business, regulation means different things. You then have to go, okay, how do we institute? We call them controls from a GRC perspective. Controls are basically just like, what actions do we need to monitor and look out for? And so all of these, like for one control, you may have five different processes within that one control. And you have to stand these up. You then have to train people. And so, like, from a cybersecurity standpoint, like, you know, security awareness training is expensive because now you have to get into a compliance side of things of how often are we training these people? How often are we asking them to, like, you know, it's annual to take the training, that kind of thing. What platform are we using? How are we keeping up with this stuff? So, and that's just on the user side. And, you know, for the back end folks, engineers, what have you, the security team, they're having to do a whole other slew of setting up controls to meet these regulations. So from a business perspective, the right CEOs see it as a value add, even though it's costly. But the way regulations are set up, it's even more costly for you not to comply.
Yeah. And I want to touch on the portion that you talked about, security awareness training. Let's even throw this in there. Is the security awareness training any good? Is it effective? Or are they just giving it to the people because, hey, you have to do security awareness, you know, once a year, twice a year, right? It's one of the gripes I've had forever. It's like, this security awareness training is so boring. And sometimes it's the same stuff every year. It's like, like the security awareness training is not updated with the current threats that we will face.
Sure. So I'm not going to mention the company I was at the time, but here's where we can caveat that. So I would agree with you that sometimes security awareness training is out of date, et cetera, et cetera. But we had a treasurer, like the high at the top, right? CEO, CTO, whatever. The treasurer had been fished, I think is the appropriate word. And was receiving an email that basically said the CEO needed a transfer to Asia, like overnight for like 12 million, right? And that's you go, what, 12 million? Here's what's interesting about that, Henri. The treasurer was this close to actually doing it because the CEO, she thought it was the CEO and wasn't quite familiar with how you just need to hover over the link, see who's actually sending it. They weren't up on that. And so I think it's these basic skills. Like if you're teaching for every endpoint that a user is touching technology, if you're just teaching them the basics, regardless of if it's, you know, the training's up to date, it's the simple and the small things that can prevent ransomware and $12 million walking out the door.
It's always the simple thing, but do they care? No, that's their risk acceptance. We'll roll with it. You know, think about it. We got people that'll drive the cars with no headlights, one headlight, no seatbelts, bad brakes. Like, I'm not surprised by what companies do. It's the same thing, just on a larger scale. So I'll say, okay, I got two more questions. I kind of just thought of some that I could ask. But looking to the future, what do you think like the biggest privacy challenges, you know, in the organizations will face? And how do you think they can prepare for them? Now, I know we've been talking about the whole time AI, machine learning. Like I said, I brought up augmented reality. And for the people that's watching, augmented reality is if you watch Marvel, all the stuff that you see Iron Man do, all this stuff, that's augmented reality, right?
Yeah.
So imagine somebody maybe injecting some of that and you're not seeing what you're supposed to see. That's just another use case you can think about when it comes to data. So maybe you think you're inputting the right stuff and then you send the wrong thing out. From that, like at a high level, what have you been seeing the trends kind of shift towards when it comes to privacy?
Like what we need to be concerned about as users? Yeah. Or okay.
Well, not as users. Yes, I guess the second part would be as users, but more so like what would companies need to be concerned about? Because sometimes companies are too late to address the things that they should be addressing when it comes to privacy.
I would say that companies need to, like, I think about user trust. I come back to user trust, right? Which has nothing to do with technology. It's just all about the relationship you have with the user and the company brand, right? Does this user trust your product? So I'm going to pick on Facebook as an example. If anybody, you know, paid attention to the whole Cambridge Analytica scandal, you know, you can go out on Netflix and watch the documentary. It was the smallest thing that screwed Facebook. It was a third party company who was abusing the data, but Facebook took the hit because that information was coming through Facebook, right? And so I think about the biggest threats to an organization happen to be third party vendors. Vendor management, that's a whole, again, you could stay employed doing vendor management, making sure that whatever integrations you have, whatever data lakes, data warehouses you're setting up, that they are protected against hackers coming in and getting this type of information, right? So, yeah, I would say it's always been and will continue to be protecting the organization against bad behaviors from third-party vendors, because you can control everything inside of your walls. You know, you can whitelist, blacklist what's getting in and out, but from a vendor perspective, you have no idea what their controls are. And you can trust that SOC 1, 2, or 3, right? But are they doing that on a regular basis? Do they say what they, are they doing what they actually say they were doing? Naomi, I see your comment. My role at Disney at the time, I was a senior IT auditor within the enterprise organization. Go ahead.
No, I was going to message you and ask where you're at Burbank then.
I was in Glendale, actually.
Okay. I went there to Burbank in, was it 2019? I want to say, yeah, early 2019, I think. I was there in Burbank. Mm-hmm. So for the viewers, this is a easy question. So if they wanted to be a privacy engineer, which is not a role, like, I probably never heard anybody come to me say, hey, I want to do privacy, right? Mm-hmm. How would they go about doing that? Or what should they focus on in order to get there? I think that's probably the best way I could ask for them. Like, if they wanted to do exactly what you do, you know, what should they try to focus on? What should they be interested in? And how can they actively look for roles doing that? Like, is it for me, like I tell people, like for cybersecurity is not typically most of the time entry level, because it needs you to know other things to secure the company. Mm-hmm. Is privacy engineering a role like that? Is it that a predicated on you actually knowing about other things in order to be an effective privacy engineer for that company?
Yeah. So I would say, well, Henri, I come from the school of thought that I can do whatever I put my mind to, whether I just got into privacy or not, like I'm gonna get the role, right? What do I mean by that? When I started at Google,
sensational.
None of my previous roles had a privacy within the title, right? I had intersections with privacy, but I didn't work in the privacy department. So for me to become a privacy engineer became, how do I align my skill sets with privacy principles and how they all kind of intersect, right? I would tell people who want to get into privacy engineering specifically, you do need to have a strong background within tech from the disciplinary standpoint. Like, you need to understand principles. So security and privacy kind of do this in the world of things. And if you understand the basics, in audit, we call them IT general controls. So things like, what do they call it? Is it identity and access management?
Identity and access management. And then they have, I think, privileged access management.
Yes. So if you understand like privileged users and separation of duties and things like that, then it's easier to understand privacy principles and concepts. So for me, and I say this to everyone, your path can be different than mine, but how I was able to finesse a privacy engineering role, I was aware of privacy principles And in order to, and I was already like, because of my IT audit background, I was well aware of different disciplines within tech, because as an IT auditor, you have to be the jack of all trades and master of none. So Henri, for what you do for a living, I couldn't compete with you in terms of like the technicality, right? Because I never drill down 5 levels on any discipline. I'm always like 3 levels down because I'm required to be able to know it all so that I can have a conversation with security. I can have a conversation with the finance folks, the legal folks, product management. So you have to know it all. And so anyway, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but for me, it was marrying my technical disciplines to privacy principles. Do I truly understand privacy concepts? And in order to do that, I went to the source. IAPP is the most well-known privacy organization. I went and saw what type of trainings they were offering. They happened to offer a cert called the CIPT. I think it's a Certified Information Privacy Technologist, I think. But I loved their training because it was basic in the sense of it married technical discipline to privacy principles. And after that, like, the rest was just all my critical thinking and being able to tie things together just based on, like, you know, previous work experience. I think also don't shun your soft skills, because as an IT auditor, I had to learn how to escalate. I had to learn how to be confrontational, because first of all, nobody likes to be audited. And, you know, I'd have people tell me they ain't giving me nothing. And you need to know how to finesse that. Either you're going to kill them with kindness, or I'm going to go straight to your VP. Like, I'm not even going to talk to you, because like, I know what my role is. I know what I was tasked and assigned to do. And I know what mandates I have from your CIO, right? So that's what I mean as far as the soft skills. It's being able to massage people in the right way, but also be in rooms with network admins and be able to talk about firewalls at length, because I've had to do that, right? And it's like, listen, full disclosure, I don't care about firewalls. I don't, right? It's not what gets me up in the morning. But I need to be able to...
Listen, I got to come back on screen for this. I totally agree with you. My last one. Data analytics, firewall rule violations. I did not care. Every time we had a meeting, it's like, I need to have the thing where Marshawn Lynch said, I'm just here so I won't get fined.
Yes!
Every meeting, that was me. Like, I was like, nah, bro.
I got to share this. So I got a girlfriend over at Uber, and we were at Fox together. So Marshawn Lynch, that's the first meme. But the second meme is the Magic Johnson one where he says, I ain't going to be here. Go look it up. It's gold. Because like at the point that I've already decided I'm going to leave a company, I just
said, No. I might pull it up just for you, because it was probably 2 weeks or 3 weeks in. And, you know, Keith Sweat got the song Twisted. And he's talking about, I'm not going to be here for long, because, you know, that went viral on TikTok. So that was me. It's like they looking at me in the meeting, and I'm like, and then it's just like, I'm not going to be here for long. Like that was the meme for me.
I love that. I'm going to use that. But anyway, I done got off all off on task. That's it.
Yeah. And it's funny, because I did not ask you this earlier, and I had every intention to ask you this, you know, seeing that we're pretty much finna go into March, the best month of the year. How has it been? So 20 years in the game as a Black woman in tech, how is that? Because from my personal experience, like watching you all, like if you've been on my teams before, I know people give you guys a hard time for no reason. And you have to, like you said, you got to go be confrontational and do all these other things to get your job done. Stuff that you really shouldn't have to do. But I've seen you guys have to do that just because them other people, I'm not going to call them out, but them other people be trying to just do stuff to y'all for no reason.
Them light green people, we like to call them light greens. Yeah.
Yeah. Like all the time, just not giving you the access you need somewhere, not giving you your documents. So now you got to go over their head and do that. Like it would be simple stuff. And these are things that I didn't really face as a man, but I saw one of my coworkers at the time, they were going through this. And I'm like, why is he not giving you the access to do your job? Like it was crazy. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. How have you been able to do that, and how you've been able to succeed for such a long time? Because, you know, it can be rough on y'all in corporate America, you know. you do have to be somebody different. It is a game that, you know, I think I finally, I'm going to say mastered, but I'm very good at it in the last 3 years. I'm very good at it now. Yeah. But it's something you have to learn. You know, it's not something if you're, and I didn't ask too much about like your parents' background. Like for me, they're not corporate people. Mm-hmm. In the immediate family, it wasn't too many corporate people I can go talk to. So even learning that, you doing on the job training, first learning your job, then learning, hey, how do I finesse my way through here to make the best decisions for myself? Those are, it's just like crazy when you think about it. Like, how were you able to do that, sustain it for as long as have you been doing it like this far?
Yeah. 2 points and a story to that. So I tell anyone, and I see the comment about code switching, absolutely. Value systems are important, Henri. So, and I say value systems because I call my YouTube channel The Only Girl in the Room for a reason. Since I started in like fourth grade, gifted and talented, I was always the only girl and always the only Black person in the room. At conferences, it's the same darn thing. In courses, it was the same darn thing. In conference rooms, it's the same thing. And so you are going to come across people who, a good analogy for this is, you walk in the room and they see you as a tattered pair of shoes, right? Whereas I walk in the room and I see a pair of Louis Vuittons, right? It's all about who, how they value you. But the better question is, how do you value you? And so to my second point, I ride for Black women. I love Black women. But in tech, I rep for all women because we have it 10 times harder than the men do. And so whether she be white, Asian, Indian, it doesn't matter. Her struggles look different, but we are still feeling it. And so from a story perspective, when we talk about value systems, let me give you an example of what I mean. I recently, you know, we had layoffs at work and I lost my manager. Well, prior to losing my manager, he had asked me to take a writing course, and because he thought my writing could be improved. And to that, I was on the inside fuming, right? And this is where the code switching comes in, because most people look at me and, you know, you don't really see any bags under my eyes. And because I have a playful personality, I like to tell people I'm 12 because I never take myself seriously. They think I have just come off the turnip truck. Like, they think I am fresh out of college and I don't, or I'm a 2 year, you know, experienced person. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm 43 years old. I've seen it, done it, probably could tell you who did it before you did it. Right. And so anyway, when he told me to take a writing course, I was fuming on the inside, but on the outside, I was like, okay, sure. No problem. Now here's what I found interesting. When he got laid off, I wrote a LinkedIn post about him, about how he was so valued in the company. That post went viral and had over 1 million views. When I later ran into him, he was thanking me about it. And I said, you know, for me, it wasn't a big deal. Why did you think it was special? Because I couldn't quite figure out why it had gone viral. And he was like, it was just written so well. And I just looked at him, because here's the thing. I know I can write. You didn't. And so this is what I talk about in terms of value systems. How do you value you? Because you're going to have people come and tell you, you don't know what you're talking about. You're going to have people come and double check your work. You're going to have people come and rewrite you, right? They didn't like the way you wrote something. And so they'll rewrite it the way that they like it. But the point is, if you know how good you are, you don't ever need somebody to tell you how good you are. And if they do tell you, you'll know how to back up those facts. I'm going to stop talking because I'm telling myself.
No, that's how I feel sometimes too. I'm like, it's definitely like that. It can be like that at a job or interview process. I remember I did an interview when I was finna leave the company that I left in the summertime. I did this interview with this one company. And honestly, I feel like they BS'd a couple of questions on it. I still felt like I actually did well enough to get that role, and they passed. But the funny thing was, months later, that director reached out for a higher level position. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I interviewed for, you know, this role, yada, yada, yada. She was like, oh, well, maybe the feedback might not be whatever. And I was like, well, I hate to inform you, but the role you're reaching out to me for, I'm interviewing for these level roles now. And I got some offers like on the table. So I was like, forget what they talking about, because they probably just hating anyway. I was like, you can either talk to me or not. Like, don't let that feedback let you, you know, miss your blessing.
It's that, right? I had a company prior to moving over to Google. I was interviewing with a startup and, you know, they put me through 6 or 7 interviews, right? And they, like, I remember talking to people twice. They end up picking a guy. He was an Asian guy who, to my 10 years experience, had 3.
And I was, why ain't no way, boy?
Why
ain't no way, boy? Why ain't no way, boy? Why ain't no way?
I get the job at Google. A year later, they reached out asking if I would interview for a director company role over there. You can kiss my ass because I knew my value then. And just because you're catching up to it, because now you see that this big company likes me, I'm good. I'm good. It's like an old boyfriend. I'm good.
What Wayne say? I ain't talking fast. You just listening slow. But that's dope. I hope they really taking in like all this game. Most of my people that are on here, they probably got to go work in the morning. That's probably not on here right now, but they're going to see this in the morning. But now I want to ask you, and I kind of already know based on what you said, and it's kind of probably some of the same reasons why I started my content and my channel. What inspired the Only Girl in the Room YouTube channel?
Say that one more time, Henri. I missed the last part.
Okay. I was saying, what inspired you to start the Only Girl in the Room, your YouTube channel?
Yeah, it was during the pandemic. I was
like most of us.
I'm sitting in my living room in LA. I got a 600 square foot apartment and I ain't got nothing else to do. So I was like, let me just see what this is about. And my friends call me Lil Oprah, right? Because like I'm a really good listener. And I got that from IT auditing. You have to be an active listener. And so I'm a good mirror and reflection for folks, because in IT audit, when you go through a walkthrough with a person, you always have to regurgitate to them what they've said to make sure that you understand you're taking in the information correctly. So it taught me how to be a good therapist. Anyway, the pandemic hits, set up a YouTube channel. I got this mini Oprah thing going for me. And I was like, well, let's just see what happens. And it just kept, like, people kept reaching out like, oh my God, I love your work. I love what you do. You're so funny, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, maybe I need to just keep doing this. My issue with my YouTube channel, because I don't have 100,000 followers, I have like 2,000. And the reason for that, I hate editing. I don't want to say I got a real job because YouTube being an influencer can't be a real job, but I just don't have the time. Because
I got
like,
somebody for you.
That's all right. That's okay. I hear you. It's just, you know, incorporating that on top of like, I have a life outside of work. And on top of that, I have a very demanding job. And so YouTube has kind of fallen back a little bit, but I love it. I love it. I love doing these things too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for me, I found a medium like it's been. So before this channel, I had like a channel where I talk about boxing. I still like boxing now, but I'm switching that channel. It's going to be more so about my other passion that I like to do. I love to watch TV shows. I love to break them down as I'm watching them. Matter of fact, my girl's like, can you just not talk while you're watching the show? Because I love to break it down what's going on in the show based on how the writer's writing things, what they're trying to allude to. I just like to talk about this stuff. But I learned so much doing that. And that's what in 2020, about what, August, I think? July or August, I launched the first video on this channel. And then after that, I was like, you know, let me go and start my company. And then I said, by the end of the year, I start the podcast. And so many people hit me up in the comments. It was like, it's so refreshing to see, you know, a face that looked like mine talking about this stuff. And
you
that's
you men, black men doing this in the space. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's not that many of us. And, you know, I'm going, you know, toot my own horns. Like, you know, a lot of them not. Everybody not keeping it as real as I am, sure, because I don't like to be fake. I always like share things I've been through because that's just how I was raised from the state, you know, from the boot. So that's how we get down. We just keep it real.
Talking about Louisiana for folks who don't know.
But the thing about it was like, I always go back to when I was in college. So I'm going to date myself. I was in my freshman year in the fall of 2010. And, you know, there's no way I can get this information. Fast forward to 2023, I'm the oldest. My siblings are, I have a young brother that's a freshman right now at LA Tech. He's 18. He'll be 19 this year. A baby brother that's a senior in high school. He'll be 18 this year. I have a baby sister that is a freshman. Yeah, she's a freshman in high school this year. And she'll be turning 15 in April. So I'm the oldest. And so my brother is in senior, he's thinking about majoring in what I majored in. And he was like, yeah, I watched your videos and he asked me some questions, but I had nobody I could do that to when I was coming out of school. I couldn't reach out to somebody. Even like my initial major wasn't even like in computer information systems. It was architecture. I had nobody I could find on YouTube and they say, hey, man, I'm thinking about architecture. What you think? So the fact that I'm able to give people a perspective and what I think and just give them solid advice. And for me, I'm one of the few people that keeps their links in their bio. Like, oh, like you can click on this and you can find my LinkedIn and see my actual career to where I'm just not BSing you. And I do that for a reason, because there is a rise of people who are claiming they've been doing this and that in tech, maybe they've been in a year or two. Hey, have it. But I tell people all the time, I waited until I was like 8 years in before I even like picked up a mic and the camera and started talking.
Yeah.
Because you got to have stuff to draw from the rail. Like if you don't have a well to draw stuff from, you're going to run out of stuff to talk about and you're just going to be like BSing folks. You're not going to be able to kind of help. I can't help everybody, but I help more than enough people because I've been them on some of the levels they've been at in their career. And that's kind of like one of the things that helped me start it. On top of, you know, not having the complexion for the selection. So using that and telling them, hey, this is how we got to move on. You got to be better than everybody else. You can't be mediocre.
Yeah.
You know,
no, you're absolutely right.
If I'm having clients, I'm telling them, okay, you know, when you go to the technical recruiters, try to find somebody like you. Try to find somebody that's smiling. You know, I said, hate it or love it. They tend to respond to me the most. So that's just me being honest because that's what I've experienced. Like, honestly, that they tend to respond to me. And I'm glad that one thing about my generation is like we've been more outspoken and trying not to gatekeep and trying to help people make better decisions, because now for those lower level roles, you got robots coming in there. Or the thing that I absolutely hate is self-checkout. I hate self-checkout with a passion.
Me too. Yeah.
That's why I'd rather just go spend the extra money at Target. At least they hire some cashiers to be there. Because I'm like, why am I paying more money for inflated food and checking out my own stuff at Walmart? I'm like, nah, man. This can't be life. Like, no. It should have only been maybe 4 self-checkouts and no other ones in the store.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Because they're taking jobs away from people who may be limited to only do certain things.
So I had this come up. I did a talk for an organization called Built. And, you know, this guy was kind of pressing on dark AI and how they're coming for our jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And my, I agree with you. I want to be very clear on me. Right. I agree with you, especially on the self-checkout. Like, don't use self-checkout, because if they don't see it as profitable, they won't do it. Right. Mm-hmm. So with the dark AI stuff, what I had to tell this guy was, instead of being the person, and I'm not saying this is you, I'm just using as an example, but instead of being the person that complains, oh, robots are going to take our job, be the person that understands and educates themselves on the matter. Because what they don't understand is this stuff is in its infancy. People like to pick on Boston Dynamics, if anyone knows who that is. You know, that's the robot dog and the thing that can do the flips and all that.
Okay.
It took them 30 years to develop that, right?
Wow.
And so you think about AI, you think about robotics, like it's in its infancy. So to say that we call it human in the loop, you're going to need people to assist this technology, right? And so make sure you're in front of that so that when the jobs get eliminated on the low end, you're on the high end. You're that person that is operating that new AI that has replaced that job, because that AI still has to be monitored, still has to be worked on, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just another way to think about how can you be part of the conversation instead of the complainer in chief.
Right? Yeah, definitely. My motto since 2020 has been, am I going to be a complainer or a changer? So that's definitely me, like getting ahead of like learning a new technology so you can stay relevant with your skills.
Absolutely.
That's pretty much it. We have many questions. I know one of the ones people were trying to figure out, they were asking, where is it? They said, how do you stay updated on trends? Do you review articles, search online, or listen intensively?
Yeah.
I'll put it right here so you can see it again.
So how do I stay up on trends? Two things. I love LinkedIn. I think LinkedIn is a gem. I follow people those people are posting articles and interesting things. I join groups for the things that align with what I'm trying to be interested in, right? Because mm-hmm. they're posting things. What you'll notice in the privacy community on LinkedIn, like, you know, I forget his name at the moment. I think his name is Jay, but he was doing privacy at Twitter. So like some of these big tech companies, like the privacy engineers are all like following each other, and they prompt these very interesting questions, and the interesting things come in the comments. And so that is how I stay up on trends. I also follow, you know, I read Wired articles, mm-hmm. TechCrunch. Listen, I will never visit a TechCrunch website, but the email newsletter, yeah. I read that bad boy every time it come out, because that is how I'm following and keeping up with who's doing what. Like, people just discovered OpenAI, but I remember when that was announced, when Microsoft threw in their seed money, like, you know, because I was paying attention. So yeah. Going back to my Will Smith, you ain't never got to get stay ready.
Yeah, that's funny. Funny enough is that when I sent you that article, I wasn't on TechCrunch website. In my Slack space, I have a channel called Security News, and it sends me different RSS feeds. So if it's interesting, yeah. I share it out. That's how I shared out the LastPass hack. It's been other hacks I shared out. It's one of the ways that make people feel like I'm on top of things, but really I'm just letting technology work for me.
So. That and also conferences. Right. Yeah. So if you're into like a discipline, whatever that may be. So for me, it's privacy. I attend privacy conferences because 9 times out of 10, they're sharing white papers or the next best thing. They're already having those conversations there.
Right. Speaking of, we need you at Afrotech this year. Just letting you know.
I'm going. It's okay. Already been. We're going.
Okay. Okay. I'm, you know, the viewers are watching this right now. I am trying to pitch to speak with a friend. So hopefully I get to speak at Afrotech. So I will definitely keep y'all guys updated on that. Shout out to my guy, Professor Black Ops. He was saying GDPR and CCPA are hidden gems. She's talking real game. That's my guy right there. See, you've been in at 20. He been in at 30.
Oof. I'm sorry.
Yeah, man. That's my guy right there. JoJo has been saying you've been doing a Disney's thumbs up the whole thing.
Get him on Amazon.
he's talking about this.
Yep.
Let me see if we got any more questions in here. My God, Nigel. He's one of the people that does vulnerability management and threat intelligence at his current company.
So CyberCloud, my sister likes to tell me, you have the white man's resume. And that is not what I set out to do. It was, I always made sure that my curiosity was reflected outwardly so mm-hmm. that when... In other words, I ain't ever got to get ready because like my LinkedIn is updated so Thanks. That people know exactly what I'm working on.
I've been doing it for.
I will tell you this. Recruiters come after me like men.
I'm going to gunshot for every time you say something.
It's true. So the way that my resume has been set up, those companies always came after me. I haven't applied for a job since I left waste management, which was in 2008.
I might tell you a joke. But I never tell you a lot.
Facts.
I think about when we say your LinkedIn, we say the way your LinkedIn set up. I thought about that old Kevin Hart joke, but he was like, the way my account set up.
Yes.
Okay, look, JoJo has we got two questions. Jill Quimbo says, do you have any advice for someone who's pivoting from being a chef to break into GRC?
Yeah, Gerard, I would say what makes you want to get into GRC, and it goes back to that whole, you start doing the work and you realize you hate it. That number one. Number two, I would say, and I tell this to everybody who signs up for like a mentoring with me, align. I would want you to, like, I have a little framework that I do for my own pivoting, right? I would want you to write down every skill that you have done. A good way to do that, you hear about the STAR method within tech. It stands for situation, task, and Henri can help you out with the rest.
I get it, the STAR method. I just remember the stories and how I came up with the conclusion.
It's essentially storytelling, right? So pick the hardest challenges you had being a chef and write them out in STAR method. So I had a situation, here was the task, the challenge, and here was the result basically, right? Write 10 of those things based on your chef skills, right? Then take that and go search LinkedIn for how those skills are showing up in job recs. That will tell you what type of technical role that you could possibly potentially be. Don't limit yourself to just GRC. That's the only reason I say that. So to that effect, once you've aligned
You might be a project manager, a product manager in the making.
Exactly. And they make great money too.
Especially being in a restaurant.
Exactly. Like you have to. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's all kind of roles in tech. But I will also say, Gerard, don't limit yourself to assuming that you want to be in GRC and you have to work for a tech company. Every publicly traded company has some form of GRC operating within that. So think about that. So if you don't take anything else from this conversation, it's align your skills. You can go on ChatGPT to also figure out what those skills are and align those with GRC roles and then get to the work of making sure that your educational, you know, there's pathways for education. You can go the educational route of college. I hate college, which is why I've always pursued certificates or certifications. You can find out what certifications and logistically real certifications, when I say that, find out which ones exist.
Yeah, not certificates. Certifications.
Yeah. Right.
Because people put certificates on their resume. I'm like, no, we need certifications.
Right. And then there's also, you can pursue the education through colleges that offer, I forget these programs, but sometimes they're 2-year programs.
Apprenticeships or those rotational programs?
Not so much rotational, but like, for instance, like Stanford has these courses you can take. So you don't have to be enrolled at Stanford, but you can take the courses as part of a package program. Harvard has the same thing, right? So all of these colleges and universities offer these programs, certifications that you can get if you don't want to go the 4-year route. So, all right, that's my spiel on Gerard's question. Hope that was helpful.
Yeah, and I just put it in the chat, like they can look into, I tell all my clients this, Gerald Alger has a course called the GRC Masterclass. He's on YouTube at Simply Cyber, and it's fairly cheap. It's like $30, and it's made for people with zero experience, honestly. I've had people with no experience, like in like kind of like tech stuff, and they've been able to at least get some type of interviews based on the bullet points we get from that course. So take that for you want. Here's another person. Oh, hang on, I skipped the question. JoJo said, I have a question, Aaron. How can I transfer my mortgage processor underwriter skills into GRC? I think this will probably be along the same lines as you just told Gerard, especially if you are working with mortgages and underwriting. I always say I would put this not necessarily being in banking, but still finance. And finance companies are always needing people in GRC. Take it from me. I've been in finance like the last, 2 years now. And there are things you probably had to do in your role that were within government, you know, risk and compliance. That once you write them out, you will probably see that you actually got a lot of more skills than you thought you did and how you take that to the next level. So that's me talking at a high level without diving deep in like what you really have going on.
Yeah, I'm gonna tag to what Henri said about banking, because it sounds like financial services, right? Mortgage processing. There are probably certain rules that you had to comply within that. So that makes me then think about standards. I saw PCI DSS in there, right? So in terms of what I have liked to do as an IT auditor, we call them audit programs. In order to build an audit program, I've gone out and found standards that apply. So I think about NIST. We've all heard of NIST. We've also all heard of FedRAMP. So going from mortgage company to underwriting, the first thing I think about, because it has writing in the title, is technical writing. Very much a role you can do if you're doing underwriting. But in terms of financial services, I would go and look at FedRAMP and see what type of standards exist, what has to comply with that, and how do those skills transfer to what you're doing right now.
Right. And this is what he said right here. So he said he has used skills in his mortgage field to make sure all customer bank accounts, credit reports, and background pass audits before pre-approval. He had to help entry-level teammates understand the loan.
So, I mean, you could be a finance auditor at this point. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Andrea Sawyer says, is EDX a good venue for certification? I'm not too familiar with EDX. Are you?
Yeah. So Andrea or Andrea, however you pronounce your name, I would tell you that I don't endorse any one of them. And here's why. I use Udemy. I forget how you pronounce it.
Udemy.
Udemy. Yeah. I actually love Udemy because I can pay $10 to just see if I'm interested, get my feet wet and just, but here's the thing. The course may be crap, but it helps me to kind of, do I understand these concepts? Is this something that I'm enjoying? Because if I am, I'll go to the next route. I actually do like Udacity, Coursera. I think Coursera is in the running for number one besides LinkedIn Learning when it comes to legit courses. But EDX, I know that they have like, I think they have Yale and a bunch of other like Carnegie Mellon or CMU. They have those courses you can take. It really just depends on the industry that you're trying to be in, because like, you know, archaeology, I don't know how you're going to use that in the world of tech, but like, I know there are courses on EDX that you can take for that. So.
Cool. Let me see if we got any other questions. I don't think we have any. Yeah, we just have people just asking about how they can support. You can support the channel by, you could join my LinkedIn. I mean, not LinkedIn. You could join my Patreon. You know, join the Patreon. That just goes right back into the channel so I can do more things, because in the future, I would like to have something like this be actually in person. Mm. You know what I'm saying? I say, hey, Aaron, you know, we got the sponsors. Here's your plane ticket and blah, blah, blah.
Love it. Put that, it out there.
That's what we need right now. So join the Patreon so we can do stuff like that. And that's for me. I always like when you guys show up and show out. Let me see. One more person came in. All right. I currently work within the Air Force as a client systems technician. I'm looking to move into a cloud IAM engineer role once my contract is up. I'm currently working on my MIS degree and my on track. When are you getting out?
I would say, JR, as far as the right track, let me tell you where you're on the wrong track. What is a client systems technician? Think about,
you know, the military does do different names.
I know, but look at it from, I'm coming from a storytelling perspective. Like, what is your narrative? If I were a recruiter scouring LinkedIn for a role that I have available and you're perfect for it, because I don't know what a client systems technician is, you're going to miss the opportunity. A recruiter is going to spend 5 minutes looking at your LinkedIn page to see if you have the skills. So figure out how you can break down client systems technician into things that are familiar relative to cloud IAM engineer. That way you can start to get the hits. So what all I'm trying to say is it's all about the narrative. How do you get to your yeses quicker? Make sure that you're not allowing people to tell you no based on they read two sentences. Oh no, this is not what I want. And they keep going. So it's all about your messaging.
Right. And what I would say is, to add on to that, learn how to normalize your job title. If your job aligns with like other IT type of roles, but it's just got a different name, change it to a more streamlined name so you get more hits on that versus you having to always try to explain what a client systems technician is. So for example, when I do clients' resumes, and sometimes they do help desk, what I'll do is assess what they have on their job description and a resume. And if it aligns with system admin, I change it to system administrator because it's a more appealing title than help desk. So whatever you do as a client system technician, if it aligns with something else, change it to that. And then also study what you need to know about, you know, being in identity and access management. I have two episodes on identity and access management. You can start there. Then you can just start researching things. And also the benefit of the cloud is that you can set up your own cloud environment and play with the identities, and you can do different, manipulate them, whatever you want to do to them. And you can just destroy it at the end of the day. So that's the benefit of the cloud and probably where you should start. It's like research what you want to do, like we said earlier in the stream. And really write down those preferred qualifications, because that's something I said this week too. It's like the preferred qualifications are what they really are looking for. Mm-hmm. So if you have some of those plus a good network, you got a good mouthpiece, because the person who is the most skilled for the job doesn't always get it. The person who sells themselves the best in the interview, most of the time, is the person that gets their role.
So true.
And that's what you have to figure out. It's, you know, I'm going to leave y'all with this. It's like, you know, Tinder. Yeah, go find your angles, get you some good profile pictures, have a decent bio, you know, swipe right and let the best man win. That's kind of how you got to do it. Like, right. You got to present your best self before you get to that woman. But Aaron, did you want to leave our viewers with anything tonight?
Wow. I feel like I've said all I needed to say, but I guess maybe the last thing is I hate to hear the term, I'm trying to break into tech. And that is because you already belong here. You just are trying to find the path, right? So don't ever say I'm trying to break into tech. No, I'm trying to find where I belong is what you're after. I would tell people, I don't care what it is that you're doing. it's possible for you to have a technical role, but not everyone is going to enjoy technical roles. Technical roles are built for a certain type of individual. So don't chase the money, chase your passion. I know that sounds kind of cheesy, but it's true, because if you're passionate, you'll show up every day and it not feel like work. I've been at Google for 2 years, and for 2 years, the hardest things I've had to do, they didn't feel like work, because I was being challenged and I loved it. So don't chase work. Don't chase money. Chase passion. That's, again, I know it's cheesy, but it's true.
Yeah. And I just want to add on to what she said. I don't like the term aspiring. Aspiring gets on my nerves. There's no aspiring in job descriptions. Stop saying you're aspiring to do this. Just put the title, work towards the steps to be that title, and you'll be all right. Join the Patreon. Check out Course Careers if you're trying to get into tech sales career. They got an IT course by Josh Matacor. And they have some more courses. Very affordable. And they have good success stories on YouTube. So check them out. My link will be in the description. And I just appreciate everybody that's been rocking with me, man. We're at, 11,000 subs now. Let's get to 50,000. You know, let's really run the numbers up this year. But like I always say, guys, until next time, let's stay textual. It's your boy HD, and I'm out.